the ideas, the leaders, the lives that are shaping Denmark and the world. From Blockshub in Copenhagen, Denmark, this is Global Denmark.
Welcome back to the Global Denmark podcast. How can one be happy in the time of Corona? That was a question that I was wanting to get an answer to. So I called up our alumnus and old friend, Mike Viking. Mike, as you know, is one of today's most influential happiness researchers in the world, the author of several books, including the New York Times bestsellers, The Little Book of Hygge and The Little Book of Lykke. He's also authored the recent book, The Art of Making Memories. He's sold over 1 million copies worldwide, and they've been translated to over 35 languages. Mike is also the founder and CEO of the Happiness Research Institute and a highly respected speaker on such topics as happiness and hygge. So we decided to dive into happiness in the time of Corona. We also looked at new initiatives centering on the opening of the Happiness Museum here in Copenhagen, a groundbreaking new report that Mike and his team have been working on in terms of well-being adjusted life years that is going to hopefully transform the way that governments and corporations invest in maximizing well-being for the most amount of people. So lots and lots of good stuff here with Mike, and I hope you enjoy. So without further ado, we bring you the king of hygge himself, Mike Viking. All right, we are back with today's guest and one of the distinguished Global Denmark Podcast alums, Mr. Mike Viking. Mike, how you doing?
Good, Thomas. Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
It is a pleasure. You know, a lot of people have been asking us to get the Tiger King on the podcast. So I said, well, I can't do that, but we can get the King of hygge. So we'll have to settle.
Very good. Very good. No similarities beyond that.
That's a positive. Absolutely. Oh, Mike. Well, yeah, it's great to have you back here via Skype, unfortunately. But yeah. We know the COVID situation. I'm talking to a lot of people, and I know from myself, a lot of people are searching for how can they create a win out of this situation and have the most amount of happiness or highest amount of well-being. So I'm really curious what your thoughts are on happiness in the time of COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, it's that exact question we have also been asking ourselves and a lot of the other people. So 4 weeks ago, we embarked on a new kind of an emergency study, basically trying to understand, you know, how does COVID-19 impact well-being, mental well-being, and what can we do to mitigate the negative effects of this situation. So we have around 4,000 or 5,000 people in our study, and we're actually trying to follow those people over time, because that's the best thing we can do when we're looking at understanding happiness, is to follow people over time to see how changes in their life circumstances impact life satisfaction, what kind of emotions people experience, and so on and so on. So the results are not in yet. Obviously, there are negative effects from the situation, but what kind of strategies we can use to mitigate that, that's what we'll be looking into when we can start doing the analysis.
Okay, are there any early indications or data trends that you're seeing in terms of this cohort?
Surprising things and unsurprising things. So to me personally, it was surprising that people with pets are less happy, that having a dog was actually a predictor of being a little bit unhappy. And to me, that's the biggest surprise ever I've seen.
Well, my dog is in the room right now as I'm recording.
I'm a huge fan of dogs, but I think what we're seeing here is that people with dogs are perhaps more distressed because the dogs are distressed over the situation. Could also be that it's a special kind of people who get dogs. So we're not exactly sure how to interpret that. And then other findings, unsurprising category would be that if you have access to a garden or access to a balcony, then you are less likely to go for a walk, go outside. So we're still trawling through the data, but it's really great that we get so many people signing up for the study.
Yeah, 4,000 to 5,000, that's impressive. I can imagine with the social distancing, especially this inability to embrace others with a hug or to see friends, visit grandparents or even sick relatives, what kind of impact that has on well-being in a negative way.
Yeah, but I also see that people are finding new ways to get together. Personally, I've had more Skype beers in the past month than I've had in my entire life. I mean, it's of course not the same, but I think it's an okay substitute these days. I've met up with people I went to uni with, five people. We were having beers. That was a good evening. I've spoken to my brother, my dad, different kinds of people. So I think, I mean, yes, these are not ideal situations, but I see a lot of people trying to make the best of it and finding out new ways to get together. Personally, I've also spent more time cooking and reading than usual. You know, books have this wonderful ability to allow us to travel in time and space, so we can explore other continents from the comfort of our own couch in the living room. And I think that's a very useful ability these days.
Absolutely. So I guess what you're saying too is that you can create hygge digitally with these kind of Skype beers and other it is intentional connectivity
I
just
think,
in the
yeah,
virtual realm.
I think that's what we have to do these days with the social distancing guidelines. I think it's a fair substitute.
Well, when are you going to be publishing those results? Are you going to be following them all the way through the impact after the society reopens in terms of economic impact and all these things, or?
That's the plan. And we have people from many different countries. And of course, the different countries are in different situations, and lockdown will be eased at different times in those countries. So it would be interesting to follow people for as long as we can. And of course, as long as we can get people to answer all the silly questions that we would like to answer them or ask them. You know, that's always the balance with a lot of these studies. You know, we want to ask 1,000 questions and people want to answer three. So we're trying not to overburden people with too many questions all the time, but still we want to get quite fine-grained data on the things we're trying to understand.
Yes. I remember in the first time we spoke, we kind of talked about that happiness in terms of the way the index looks at it is kind of almost the least unhappy where the basics of human well-being are in order. Do you see that in terms of the Nordics being in any way under threat in terms of their perennial position on top of the World Happiness Index?
No, I think the last time we spoke, I joked about the Nordic countries not being the happiest in the world. I said they were the least unhappy, because the World Happiness Report is based on a national average, as many reports are. So there is a high national average in the five Nordic countries, and you know, you can call them the happiest in the world or the least unhappy. That's still the case today. I think with the situation we are in, I think the Nordic countries are in a good position. They have relatively good social safety nets in terms of unemployment. And I think there has also been in a lot of the countries, you know, fairly good backing towards the government guidelines. Of course, the government guidelines are very different in the five Nordic countries, but they receive a lot of public support, whether they pick one strategy or the other. And I think that's a testimony to the high level of trust there is towards the government in the Nordic countries. So I don't see that being jeopardized because of the situation. I think you'll still see the five Nordic countries in the top 10 in the World Happiness Reports in the coming years.
Okay. Yeah, I know Denmark is sitting there at number two on the
Yeah.
latest.
Yep. Finland once again beat us to it. As you know, we have two strategies to regain first place in the World Happiness Report. We can try and make the Danes happier or the Finns less happy. So maybe we should try and beat them in hockey at one point.
That would be a tough task, but definitely handball. Definitely handball.
Definitely. Yep.
Well, here's to hoping the Finns crash and burn tonight. All of our Finnish friends out there, yes. So I heard you are opening a new museum, which perfect timing, by the way.
We are. It is the perfect timing. It is the perfect timing. No, so for the past 2 or 3 years, I've been planning on expanding the Happiness Research Institute with a small museum. So the plan was to open the Happiness Museum in May, but I think it was Mike Tyson that said, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And I think a lot of us feel that way about 2020.
The year of
So, I
Tyson.
mean, so May is probably not realistic now, but we hope for being able to be open the Happiness Museum in June. We have found a location in Admiralgade in the heart of Copenhagen,
Okay.
and are going to do a small museum, 240 square meters, around sort of the history of happiness, the politics of happiness, the science of happiness, geography of happiness. So a small museum, but but basically about the big questions and the big things in life.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's probably my worst business idea ever. I mean, I think, to be honest, you can make a small fortune running a museum. The trouble is you have to start with a large fortune.
Yeah, that helps in life.
No, but we'll open, and I mean, we'll start out small, having less people in the museum than was the plan. And we're doing that. We're doing the museum because we think it would be really fun and a great learning experience for people. And we get a lot of people writing the Happiness Research Institute asking whether they can come by, because you know, the Happiness Research Institute sounds like a magical place where we eat ice cream and look at puppies all day.
There's a lot of pressure there, Mike. They better be coming out with smiles. Exactly. On their face.
So, but we're just looking at data in front of computers. But we thought, let's create a place where we can bring happiness to life and where we can give people an insight in the work we do and happiness from different angles. So that's the aim with the museum.
Excellent. I think if you have kind of an unlimited ice cream truck and unlimited Carlsberg in the museum, you'll be in good shape.
Pretty good start.
Just my two cents. Well, definitely keep me posted. It'll be great to see that open up.
Yeah.
A new element to Copenhagen. I know, a lot of people globally, they're always asking, about Hugin happiness here. What's the recipe? And I think having a museum will be a big draw, because people are looking for happiness. That's a universal. Absolutely.
Especially in these times.
Indeed. Well, what else are you up to? I know you kind of mentioned off air this new report coming out. Maybe you could say a word about that.
Yes. So it's a report we've been working on for the past 2 years. And I think it's actually our most ambitious, most important report that we've ever done. So we've been working together with a German company called Leaps by Bayer. Basically, what we've tried to do is to create a universal metric that can measure a happiness return on investment.
Okay.
So it is it's called WALI, so well-being adjusted life years, which gives us a tool to understand if we can cure disease A or disease B, which disease should we cure in order to bring most happiness to humankind.
Mm.
Super tricky, super ambitious, but super important, because right now I think a lot of decision makers are having a tough time making tough choices with very little evidence. I mean, these days, we're also debating, how many jobs is a human life worth? Of course, it's a super difficult position to be in as a decision maker or as a politician. But a lot of people are having to make those choices when you look at the sort of impact investor community. If you can cure one disease or the other, which one should we actually cure to bring most well-being to humankind? So that's what we've been trying to do. And also a metric that can actually go beyond health. So something that can look at the well-being impact of pollution and different other domains, so not just health. So super ambitious, super ambitious report. We've been working on it for more than 2 years.
Okay.
And that's out today, called the Well-Being Adjusted Life Years.
It's out right now. People can.
Yes.
Okay, we'll have to get that up on our site. Look forward to reading that. That sounds highly ambitious. And I'm just curious, Mike, if you were to give an example. So if a government is looking into how they should invest, or a corporate, in terms of what disease should be treated, maybe you could break it down for a little bit, a concrete example.
Yes. So we've been using a huge data set with more than 150,000 people in it from Europe who are 50 years and above. And some of them have been followed since 2002. And because it's such a large amount of people over such a long period of time, and that age group, people are unfortunately being diagnosed with different diseases during the course of that study. So you have around 1,400 people who are diagnosed with Parkinson's, for instance. And then you can see, because those people are asked every 2 years around a lot of things, around their health and mental well-being and their life satisfaction. And then we can start to see what is the average impact of being diagnosed with Parkinson or Alzheimer's or different cancers or mental disorders. How does that affect your life satisfaction?
Okay.
How does it also affect the life satisfaction of your spouse? Okay. For example, we can see Alzheimer's is just something that over time will actually impact your spouse more than you, because at a certain point you might be oblivious that you are suffering from Alzheimer's.
Right.
We're trying to then see, okay, if we could look at the prevalence of different diseases combined with the impact that disease have on life satisfaction, how much happiness is actually ruined or lost each year due to that disease. So if we could cure Parkinson, Alzheimer's or third disease, which one should be prioritized in terms of lifting humankind out of misery?
This is going back to my philosophy education. We're talking about a utilitarian, it's almost hedonic calculus in terms of the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest number, right?
Right.
Fantastic. That's wonderful to hear that you guys are putting such an effort into that. And I really hope that it can create these data-driven qualitative measures for making great policy choices.
Exactly. And I mean, that's basically what we're trying always to do at the Happiness Research Institute. Let's bring some data, let's bring some evidence on the table to allow us to make better decisions for better lives. So we always try and answer, how can we measure well-being, quality of life, happiness? Why are some people happier than others? And how can we improve quality of life? So this is a big brick in that cathedral that we're trying to build.
That's such a fantastic purpose and mission to have, Mike. That's well done. Well, I know you had a book out last time we were speaking. It was just coming out at the time, I believe, called The Art of Making Memories, How to Create and Remember Happy Moments. Is that correct?
That is correct. Well remembered.
Apropos. So we didn't have a chance to kind of map it out last time, but maybe you could kind of give the thesis of the book and what you were looking for and what some of the feedback you've gotten since it's published.
Sure. Yeah. So I think that the motivation for the book was sort of twofold. So professionally, I could see that people who are able to retrieve happy memories, people who are able to form a positive narrative about their lives, are also happier overall. And we see when people are living with depression, they're not only struggling with feeling unhappy right now, but they're actually also struggling with remembering any time in the past they were happy. So there was some professional interest in that. And then the other dimension was, personally, I turned 40 almost a couple of years ago. And that means, statistically speaking, as men in Denmark live to, we are 80 on average. I had lived half my life.
Yes.
So I just started to reflect on the first half, you know, which were actually my happiest moments. And, you know, why do I remember what I remember? And how can I use that knowledge going forward and create future happy memories? So that was sort of the motivation for the book. And then I look, you know, why is it that we, for example, remember first times better than, or new experiences better than things we've experienced over and over again? But I think that the sort of biggest aha moment for me in searching and writing the book was coming to an understanding that we can actually influence what we and our family and friends remember. So earlier I thought of memory as something random, something I did not have control over. But now I can actually see that we are called memory architects, that you have the ability to influence what you remember in the future or what your family remembers in the future. And I'll give you a little
what's the key?
Yes, different keys. But I think the very most simple tool is attention. So there was a Polish woman I spoke to who had read my book, and she was reminded of a time when she was about 8. And at that time, she's having dinner with her sister and her mother, and they're having a good time. They're laughing and enjoying themselves. And then at one point, her mother turns to her and her sister and says, "I hope you remember this moment." And here we are 30 years later, this lady still remembers that moment because her mother made her pay attention to it. Now, of course, it's a simple tool. It's a powerful tool. It's also a tool that can be overused, because if you, every time you sit down with your daughter, say, "I hope you remember this moment," I think eventually she's going to tell you to shut up, right?
Yeah.
But used every once in a while, I think it's a powerful tool.
Something happens then neurologically where your neurons think, okay, we need to connect on this one.
Yes, we need to store that information. And basically your memory works through association. So you see something, you smell something, you hear something, and that triggers a memory. So it's why you listen to suddenly you listen to a song you heard in high school, and then you are instantly transported back in time and re-experience that memory. But that also means that we can build in different memory triggers into our memories and give them more dimensions. For instance, Andy Warhol, what he would do was he would wear the same perfume for 3 months at a time and then never wear that perfume again, and then switch to another one for 3 months and then another one for 3 months and so on and so on. And that meant over time he had actually created a museum of scent or museum of memories.
Oh, wow.
So he could say, now I want to go back to the spring of 1984 and then take a whiff of that perfume and then see which memories would be triggered by that scent.
Okay, so in the senses, you can architect these memories by these triggered memories.
That's interesting. Exactly.
Is there a difference between the art of making, you know, memories that are positive or negative? Do we remember negative events more keenly or positive, or does it depend on where we focus our attention?
It's the same mechanisms. It's the same factors that allows you to remember good and bad. So we also remember things, for example, in the book I talk about using the emotional highlighter pen. That means that we remember things that are emotional, whether we feel ashamed, whether we're extremely happy, and so on and so on. Some of the most embarrassing things that have happened to us, we are likely to remember that forever. And in the book, I also talk about one of my most embarrassing experiences, which was on live TV in the UK. This must have been back in 2017.
Okay.
I was talking about my newest book at the time, which was The Little Book of Lücke. Mm-hmm. And I was on this, it's called This Morning Show in the UK. And I think they have 4 million viewers or something like that. So almost as many viewers as I
the size
I
of Denmark.
Yes, exactly, right? And I remember talking to my publicist before the interview, and I can't remember what she said, but it was basically, don't screw this one up.
Yeah,
and spoiler alert, I did. So it's live, and I think the interview is going okay. And then towards the end, one of the hosts, he says, so earlier you've written about Hygge, now you've written about Lücke, what are you going to write about next? And I thought his Danish pronunciation was really good, and I just wanted to compliment that.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of people in the UK, they've been watching a lot of the Danish TV dramas, right? So The Killing and Borgen and so on.
Yeah.
So I say, hey, well done on pronouncing Danish. You must have been watching a lot of Danish Borgen, which is, of course, as you know, is how we pronounce it, right?
Yeah.
But he heard you must have been watching a lot of Danish porn. So he started to laugh. All the other hosts, they started to laugh. I had no idea why they were laughing. And that was the end of the... No, and then he said, one of the other hosts turned to him and said, what did he say? I'm afraid to ask. And that was the end of the interview. So it wasn't until later that day when I read a news article about the TV host mishearing the Danish cast.
they thought you were this cheeky Dane.
Right. But of course, that was really embarrassing. So I will probably remember that till the day I die. So yeah, that's the emotional highlighter pen.
You know, yeah, and I guess when we make memories, we have these episodic memories where we remember events kind of as part of the narrative. And then there's the more emotional remembering that maybe happens unconsciously. Obviously, I can't remember anything the first few years of my life, but I know I had memories.
Right. Yes. Usually, on average, people will have their first, be able to retrieve a memory from around the time they're 3.5. But of course, you have memories beforehand. They're just not stored.
Yeah. It's kind of like a hard wiring into the emotional triggers, maybe. It's really interesting. Sounds like a fascinating book. I mean, you mentioned also that it's about focusing attention. And, you know, I practice mindfulness meditation. And a lot of that is about, you know, focusing on the breath, right?
Yeah.
And the whole point is to kind of get out of the circle of you're in the past or dwelling on memory, but you're literally just in the now.
Right.
And that's really interesting how you can intentionally, through your focus, also be in the past in a different, more intentional way.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, we have this ability to travel back in time and also travel forward. It's the same part of the brain we use when we're thinking about the past and the future. It can be difficult to stay in the moment. You know, speaking of attention, it was interesting to see, we did a large study collecting happy memories. So we collected, I think it was more than 1,000 happy memories from, I don't know, 80 different countries for research for the book. And a lot of these happy memories we got from people were from times where they were paying attention to the moment they were in. So for example, one, and not being distracted by, you know, the digital devices and so on. So I remember one family dad who wrote that his happy memory was from a time when the town was experiencing a power blackout. He and his family, they brought out candles and they sat around the candles and told their favorite family anecdotes.
Yes.
And I thought that that sounded like a really, really nice evening where attention was right there with the people he was with. So I see evidence of that point you're making.
Yeah, it's just so interesting, the ability to even create memories, and just the way you're saying, the ability to kind of be the architect of your own memories. I'm really gonna try that and try to plant little seeds in people, and then I want them to remember what I want them to remember.
Exactly.
Well, Mike, we're just having a kind of a small recording today here digitally, and I think we can wrap up the podcast today with one final question, and that is, what is your advice here in the time of Corona for happiness in Hygge? What would you say is one way we can create a positive memory during this time of hardship?
I think I would go back to what I said earlier in terms of what I try to do. I mean, these are obviously not happy times. They are indeed memorable times.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm trying to make the best of it. So I'm basically trying to do three things. So connect when it's possible digitally, calling people, having Zoom or Skype beers with people. I also spend more time cooking. So you know, food is something that brings people together in the household. So it's one of those pleasures we can get on a daily basis, you know, having a nice meal, spending time in the kitchen preparing that.
Any new dishes here in the time of Corona that you'll associate?
I've been doing a lot of hummuses lately.
So every time you stare at that hummus, you'll know those chickpeas are harvested.
Yeah, I think the beetroot hummus will be the color that will trigger the memory of the time of Corona.
Okay.
And then thirdly, I read more than I usually do, because that's the way I can explore the world now. So I've been going back to the Roman ages. I've been traveling with Marco Polo. That's how I do my travel these days.
Oh, good stuff. Good stuff indeed. Well, Mike, I really appreciate you calling in and connecting again this way too. I know our audience will appreciate it as well.
Thank you so much.
We look forward to the new museum opening. I guess you're going to be broadcasting that out when you're going to have your official opening to the public. And
yes,
maybe June.
When we punch back.
Yeah, going full Mike Tyson.
Yeah. Exactly. Very good. Thank you, Thomas.
Well, Mike, we'll look forward to seeing you when we're allowed to be in proximity.
Likewise.
Down the road. We'll catch up again. And to our audience, don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate and review, tell your friends. And until next time, see you on the GDP.
Are you getting the most out of your time in Denmark? Pick up the printed copy of the English language newspaper Copenhagen Post today to access relevant news and event information, guaranteed to enhance your working and family life.